Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm talking with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Senior Victim Advocate Vanessa Cullors and Marwa Haja Ahmed, Domestic Relations Unit Supervisor with the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court, about all things related to protective orders. Vanessa, Marwa, welcome to Unscripted and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us today.
Thank you, Kendra.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. Protective orders, also known as restraining orders, are a lifeline for many survivors of interpersonal violence, yet they remain misunderstood and underutilized. We'll try to clear up some of this uncertainty about them today. So, Mara, I'm going to start with you. Can you define protective or restraining orders for me? We're using them, the two terms, interchangeably throughout this podcast, just making a note of that. But can you define protective orders for us?
Absolutely. And thank you again, Kendra, for inviting me to this podcast and giving me the opportunity to speak about protective orders and family abuse cases as we are celebrating the Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So the definition of protective orders is a type of order that restricts the behavior of an individual to protect the health and the safety of another. Protective orders, they are about violence, acts of violence, threats of violence, and fear. And you mentioned it, that in other states, they can call it restraining orders or orders of protections. And then the person whose behavior is being restricted, that is the respondent, and then the person who is being protected, that is the petitioner. There are many types of protective orders. We have the emergency protective order, preliminary protective order, final protective order, military protective orders, and child protective orders. But we're going to focus today on talking about the family abuse cases, the domestic protective orders.
Okay, and can you give me quick definitions of the difference between emergency, preliminary, and final protective orders?
Yes. So, the emergency protective order is issued by the magistrate's office, and generally it is a protective order for a maximum of 72 hours. They are issued for the imminent danger about recent incidents of abuse while the court is not in session, such as weekends or after hours. The preliminary protective order and the final protective orders are entered by the judge. The preliminary protective order is a temporary order for 2 weeks, maximum 15 days, and the final protective orders can last for up to 2 years.
What do protective orders actually do?
So protective orders are designed for the physical safety of the petitioners. So it is for the petitioner and any household members, so any family or household members. For example, a petitioner can request that children or parents or anyone in the house to be also a protective party. And all the provisions apply to the petitioners will apply to the household members. The main concept of the protective order is to protect the health and the safety of that individual, that victim.
What don't they do? And by don't, I don't mean what they fail to do. I mean, what are they not designed to do?
They are not designed to be an ultimate solution for certain matters such as custody. They are not designed to be an alternative of custody order, or they are not an alternative of filing a divorce or a separation. So they are a temporary solution to, you know, focus on the survivor's or the victim's health and safety. They are not designed to be forever. So in Virginia, they used to be only for 2 years. We have a new legislative update that increased the duration. They can last for up to 4 years with the possible extension as well.
What don't they do? Vanessa, I'm going to direct this to you. What don't protective orders do that we wish they did?
I think we would wish that they would be absolute, that all of the relief that is included in a protective order, whether that's, you know, the custody agreement, the temporary custody agreement, visitation agreement, the terms of any exceptions to contact, that those would be absolute. I think we would wish that individuals filing for a final protective order, if those are granted, that when they walk away from court, that's kind of the end, that family can then begin to plan for peace, begin to plan to recover from what's happened, and to not have to continue to pursue more court matters, have concerns for their continued safety. I think we would want them to be a process that we start and we finish, because many individuals that are coming in for protective orders, it's not a start and finish. There isn't always a defined end. And I think for many of the victims that we work with, a defined end would be helpful.
Okay. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, either of you, protective orders, when you say safety, it's physical safety. It's not protection from financial abuse or emotional abuse. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. They, unfortunately, in Virginia Code, verbal abuse and emotional abuse are not grounds to get a protective order and let that abuse associated with the threats of a physical harm, but only financial abuse or mental abuse or verbal abuse are not grounds to get a protective order in Virginia.
I think those are the cases, though, where our advocacy services and some of our community partners can come in and work together. If we have individuals who are impacted by financial abuse or emotional abuse, advocates can talk with them about options and help them navigate. Is a protective order the appropriate option? Is this something you want to pursue? If it is around emotional abuse or financial abuse, there are still supports and services available for individuals experiencing those forms of abuse. It may not be an appropriate situation to petition for a protective order, but there are services and options available for individuals experiencing other forms of abuse.
Okay, thank you for that, because that was going to come up, Vanessa. What exactly can advocates do to support? And so they can get advocacy services support for these other issues, and in addition to filing for a protective order. This is correct?
Absolutely. We have advocacy services available at Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court. We walk alongside Marwa and her team to be able to assist petitioners seeking protective orders. We can accompany them to their ex parte hearings. We can help them answer questions, understand the process, develop a safety plan, get connected to community resources. And for individuals that may schedule an appointment and meet with an intake officer, they may decide, oh, the protective order isn't for me. We can still work with them in advocacy services and help them build a safety plan and help them with options, explain to them, you know, what's available, and be a presence for them as they're navigating what options or what strategies might work best for them moving forward.
Okay. And so, Marwa, I'm going to toss this back to you. Walk me through how to get a protective order in Fairfax County.
Alrighty. So, first of all, we need to determine the jurisdiction, the family relationship, because both the juvenile court, and the general district court provide protective order filings. So if the relationship is a family relationship, then the petitioner or the victim will come to our unit. We are located in the main courthouse in the second floor in room 202, and they will be screened by intake officer, and then we will schedule appointments for them. Because of the safety concerns, these appointments are set within 24 to 48 hours, and sometimes we see the clients on the same day. Depends on the severity of the situation, especially if there is an emergency protective order in place. So the clients, when they come to our units, the petitioners, we offer them a variety of options in terms of filing. They can file in person or they can file remotely. And this is a service that we provide because we want to avoid people from being re-traumatized. For example, they do not have to skip a day from work, and if they do have children, they do not want to bring them to the courthouse, so we offer the remote filing. So if the client decided to do it in person or whether, you know, remotely, they will be with an intake officer for 2 hours so they could, we can prepare the petitions for them. And the clients will be given 2 options. Either they can go and see the judge for a short hearing or they can file by an affidavit. And on our office, we file 2 types of protective orders. We file the preliminary protective order. It's the temporary order for 2 weeks, maximum 15 days. And we call it ex parte hearings, meaning that the judge will hear only from the petitioner. The respondent will not be a party to the case. And also we file the up to 2 years protective order. So for the preliminary protective order, we will assist the class with the paperwork. We will take them to court for a short hearing. And at that time, we rely on Vanessa and her team to provide advocacy services before the court hearing so they can prepare them for court. And then we will be with them in the courtroom while they testify before the judge for a hearing that can last between 5 to 10 minutes. And the main concept for the preliminary protective order is the imminent danger. What happened in a reasonable amount of time for the judges to ensure the safety of our victims. Regardless of the outcome, even if the judge grants, whether the judge granted or denied the preliminary protective order, the judge will set the case for a final hearing to determine the up to 4 years protective order. And the final hearing, both the petitioner and the respondent will be present in courtroom so the judge can determine the final protective order. So we are a trauma-informed agency. That is why our staff, luckily, they are very trained in terms of identifying trauma, working with traumatized clients, and then we are always seeking ways to be creative in terms of how to provide a welcoming environment for our clients when they are filing for protective orders, knowing the history of the abuse, whether it's financial or emotional or physical abuse, and then the courage that took them actually to say that I want this to stop and I want to file for protective order and I want this to end today.
How do protective orders address newer issues such as tech-enabled violence? Because that wasn't even a thing when protective orders first came into being decades ago.
So luckily, protective orders, they do address these issues. So for example, AirTag, you know, tracking devices or cell phone apps that can be used to track the petitioners or the victims, we have a language in the petitions for the protective order for the preliminary and the final protective order that forbidding the respondent from using any cell phone device or any electronic device to locate the petitioners. Also, we acknowledge cyberbullying. So we give the petitioners the options if they want to add the language in the preliminary protective order in terms of forbidding the respondent from posting anything, for example, about petitions on social media. So this is up to the judge's discretion. So protective orders, especially the preliminary, we tell the clients this is your order. So we are going to design it however you want to do. Yes, we are working with limitations, but also it gives us a little bit of flexibility in terms of, you know, acknowledging or understanding the needs of the clients in terms of, other than safety, what are the things that I want to make sure that the judge, you know, I get relief from the judge about these issues, such as temporary custody, also temporary child support and treatment. So, and definitely the newer issues, such as, like you mentioned, like the AirTag and the tracking devices, these are also things that we can cover in the protective form.
Does a Fairfax County protective order work in other Virginia counties, like, you know, Loudoun and Prince William, which are right next door, or the city of Roanoke, which is 4 hours away in southwestern Virginia? Does it work all over the state?
Yes, it works all over over the country. They are nationals, and our protective orders, when they are entered by the judge, they will go to a national system. We call it the visa system, where they are acknowledged all over the United States. Not only that, now we have a new legislative update that foreign protective orders now can be enforced in Virginia. And a foreign protective order, that's not an order that issued from a different country, but issued from a different jurisdiction, like a different state. So now a protective order issued in Maryland, if it's violated in Virginia, then the petitioner can file a violation based of that incident here in Virginia, even though the protective order was issued in a different state.
Okay, this is good to know, because I was thinking if a person who harmed me moved to Idaho, the Virginia protective order wouldn't be in effect. But this is good to know. So I'm going to take a quick pause here to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-Hour Hotline at 703-360-7273. What are some barriers to obtaining a protective order?
So some of the barriers that I can say are language barriers and culture barriers. I spoke earlier about the preliminary order that clients can file by a court hearing, but also we give the parties the options, the petitioner the options to file via an affidavit. It's a 3-page written testimony. If they do not want to see the judge, or they may not feel comfortable inside the courtroom, or they simply would believe this is convenient for them. So, but luckily, we do have translation services, so the petitioners or the victims, where they can write the affidavit in their own language, and then we will provide a translator to submit the paperwork to the court. Cultural barriers as well. Protective order still remains taboo, and Fairfax County is really a diverse community. So one of the things that our unit currently is working on and very diligent in terms of finding opportunities and, you know, to strengthen collaboration with the community. So, and we recently initiated the community outreach, where we are very active in terms of reaching out to our community, to our clients where they are. We do not want them to find ways to come to us. We want to find ways to go to them and implement our services and the resources available for them here throughout the juvenile court. It is important to acknowledge that protective order, it is not a topic that people feel comfortable talking about or share or actually taking steps and file. Because the respondents in our situation, and I'm talking about the juvenile court and the family court, the respondent in our situation is always someone that was supposed to love them, protect them the most, end up being, you know, the bad person in here. So it is not an easy topic. We are definitely seeing some of the barriers that we are seeing. Transportation, you know, for example, if we are talking about clients that they are in the, you know, South County, in the south of the county. So it is very difficult for them to come to the courthouse. They take them 3 buses, so to come to an appointment to file for a protective order. So one of the things that we recently did in April of this year, we started a satellite office. We have an intake officers in South County region that is covering the Richmond Highway area, and we filed protective orders, remote protective orders there, just to assist the clients that they do not have to take 3 buses only to come to the courthouse. And we offer them, of course, to file by an affidavit. We'll provide in-person translators that they will be located in South County. So these are some of the barriers, but also these are the things that we are working on resolving. And these are the steps that we took just to eliminate some of those barriers.
Do I have to have a lawyer to file a protective order? Or might that also be a barrier if I can't afford a lawyer?
Yes. So to file a protective order, you do not have to have a lawyer because you will have an intake officer.
Okay.
The intake officer will be able to file the petitions and to explain the process step by step. However, the clients are encouraged to hire an attorney for the final protective order, because that's still litigations that they would need to, if they presented themselves in court, that they would need to have a level of understanding about the legal system, for example, the law of evidence and how to present a case in court. So this is definitely one of the barriers. Luckily, we do have partnership with the Legal Services of Northern Virginia, so they can provide legal advice and free legal representation for our protective order clients. Now, one of the barriers as well, because they are volunteers, sometimes they do not have enough staff to cover all the protective orders that we file. So, like, for example, fiscal year 2024, we filed 1,143 petitions for protective orders. So,
oh, wow.
Yes. And not all of them will be able to be represented freely, you know, and get a free representation by LSMD. So this is definitely one of the barriers, the legal representation.
Vanessa, I know advocates are not attorneys, but can advocacy services help at least explain some options to people who can't afford an attorney but need help in that way?
We can. So you're absolutely right, Kendra. Advocates are not attorneys and we can't give legal advice, but we can explain processes.
Mm-hmm.
We can help answer basic questions about what to expect. We're not able to interpret or provide recommendations or give advice, but we can provide information about the process and what to expect, give some general recommendations about how to prepare for court, and then help make connections to, like Marwa has mentioned, our legal services of Northern Virginia. If individuals would like to reach out to the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service, we also utilize self-help opportunities through our law library, as well as through online resources. Womenslaw.org also is an option to help individuals research the process, help them understand evidence, and submit questions and get some legal advice online. So we do utilize some of those complimentary services for individuals that may not qualify for legal services, may not have the financial means to hire an attorney. We try to, you know, work within the resources and partnerships that we have to support individuals moving forward with their protective order case.
Okay. Is age a barrier? So what if the person who needs the protective order is 16? Can they file, or does someone have to file on behalf of them?
They will still be the petitioners, but we need a guardian, a party of interest, or a parent to file on their behalf. And we call these cases on behalf of a minor case.
Okay.
Tricky part will be with regards to testimony. Depends on the age of the child, because that child is still known as the petitioner. So if a child is 3 or 4 years old versus 16 years old, so that's up to the judge's discretion in terms of having the petitioner, the child, to come and testify in court. And also, we have a concept that we do not want to re-traumatize the child in terms of coming to court, being in a court hearing, and being in front of the other party, the respondent, and then testify about the abuse. So that is why, you know, with older children, I see it happens often that the judge will request for the child to testify in court, but for young ages, then the petitioner or the guardian or the person of interest, that will be the person testifying on behalf of the minor. It really depends on the age of the child and the judge's discretion in terms of ordering, you know, the child to come and testify in court.
Okay. What's good about protective orders?
Ensuring safety. Ensuring the safety and the well-being of not only the petitioner, but I would say the family as whole. And especially that our petitioners, they have they can request that family and household members to be protected. Also, the good thing about protective order, it can serve as a temporary solution for other matters not related to safety. As I mentioned earlier, it can be a temporary solution to the term of custody for the survivor to get child support if they wanna start somewhere else, or they wanna move out from the house where the abuse occurred. So having that financial support through the protective order as a temporary child support. Also, we do have supervised visitation and exchange program. So, and the judge can order, they do have the discretion to order that service through the protective order. And I believe that's a great service to rebuild and reconnect, you know, relationship between the respondent or the abuser in our situation and the children. And especially that protective orders, sometimes they can last up to 4 years. So you do not want children to disconnect for 4 years from that parents, but you also want to ensure the safety of those children, that they can meet the non-custodial parents in a safe setting where they, you know, we can ensure that the respondent, they are not saying what they're not supposed to say, they're not doing what they're not supposed to do, and they will utilize that time just to rebuild that relationship between them and their children.
So those are the good things. Let's talk about the bad. When they don't work, people, a lot of times I hear, they're just, you know, protective orders are just a piece of paper. But that's not really helpful. So, but when they don't work, what is bad?
So the protective orders, they are not in full force and effect unless the respondent is served. And it has to be in-person service. So the law enforcement, they need to, you know, talk to the respondents, explain the things that they can and cannot do to avoid violating the protective order, because that is going to be a criminal charge. But if you are not able to find the respondent, so protective orders, yes, you do have an order, but it's not in full force and effect, that if the respondent violated that order or established any contact with the petitioners, they are not in a violation because they've never been served with the protective order. So that is the time that there is a protective order in place, but it is not technically in effect, unless that the respondent is served. So this is one of the things, that sometimes we don't have an address for the respondent. Sometimes the respondent is avoiding service, you know, not where to be found. So the protective order will be in effect. So I think this is when the protective order is not as effective as we hope it would be.
I think we like to think of protective orders as well as tools in a toolbox, just mm-hmm. like we build our safety plans. You know, mm-hmm. protective orders can be one measure to help increase safety and build in accountability for respondents. We know that there are lots of things that often come along with that, though, that is also needed. So the safety planning is an important piece. Having conversations with children who are covered by protective orders. If there are other programs that are involved, if there are, you know, if it's a CPS case or if there's also supervised visitation that is involved, if there are school matters, you know, school personnel, bringing all of the providers that are supporter people to the family into conversation, I think can be helpful, because protective orders, it's one option for folks to be able to increase their safety, but I think it's part of a larger discussion of, you know, what are the other pieces that I need to be able to put in place to be able to help manage manage my overall safety. Maybe my housing, if I'm moving to a new place, thinking about filing for the address confidentiality program so that individuals who are subject to that protective order have increased safety toward other folks inadvertently finding out where they're living. So mm-hmm. there are multiple pieces to this. I think we like to think about it as tools in a toolbox to help increase safety. I think safety is our eventual goal. But how many strategies, how many options can we help individuals learn about and put in place to increase their safety?
Tamara, what happens if somebody violates the protective order?
So it depends on the violations. We have two types of violations of protective orders. We have the criminal violations that's generally related to the contact. So if the initial protective order says no contact, no exceptions, and then the respondent tried to communicate with the victim either directly or indirectly through a third party, so that's a contact violation, that is a criminal charge, and that is something should be reported to the law enforcement so they can take the appropriate actions. And there is the second type of violation, which is the civil violation. And that is for other relief that been granted to the petitioner not related to contact. For example, if through the protective order, the respondent was ordered to pay a certain amount of money for child support, or there was a temporary custody or temporary visitation, and then the respondent is not complying with those orders, that's this where the petitioner will come to our offices again to a domestic relations unit and file a civil violation. We call it a rule to a show cause, that the respondent should be held in contempt for not complying with the court order.
And what are the consequences to that? But beyond being told, hey, you didn't follow the orders, what happens?
For the criminal violation, it can be jail. Mm-hmm. Can be bond. It can be, there are so many things that it can be a part of the criminal violation. For the civil violation, again, it is less restricted than the criminal violation. It's mm-hmm. like violating custody or visitation. you know, requesting for the respondent to be, you know, held in contempt for not complying with the court order, technically, essentially that you're requesting that the respondent to go to jail for not doing that. That's the last option that the judge will do for the civil violation, not the first option, but it is a valid option. We've seen it so many times. So for the civil violation, it can be revoking their driver license. They can go up to 10 days in the county jail. And then they have to pay all the arrearages back for the child support cases. But for the criminal charges, it's more strict and more serious consequences.
Okay. And then final question I'm going to ask both of you. What can we, in what ways, how could we strengthen Virginia's protective order process?
Well, I think we started to, you know, to strengthen the protective orders. As I mentioned, we have a legislative update that a final protective order can last up to 4 years. I think it should even be longer than that. I've seen protective orders from other states that was registered here in Virginia. Some of them are for 10 years. So I would definitely hope that if we can have more time, you know, to ensure the safety of the petitioner.
Yeah, I think another way to strengthen our protective orders is to encourage consistency across enforcement. When individuals are reporting violations and they're coming to court to report and file motions for either show cause because there's been a civil violation or a contact violation, that there's consistency in our courts and consistency across law enforcement and the accountability pieces there as well.
Okay. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Vanessa and Marwa for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.